The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Folks, it's time for Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We gather like this Sunday mornings at 11, and we get to talk sports with a really interesting group of people. So glad you're with us. Our engineer is Jeff Sinis. And our producer is Andrew Herdliska. I want to welcome Larry Zonka, the great Miami Dolphin. And his book is out. It's a memoir called Head On. Larry, welcome to Orlando. I know you're living close by. Great to catch up with you. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fine, Pat. How are you doing?
I'm good, Larry. Tell me about this book. What brought it about?
Well, my life. My life and my wife. Audrey has been after me for probably 20 years, the last 20 years, saying, you need to write some of this down. You talk to people about it. You refer to it. It's in the media all the time. You need to write it down the way it happened and go back and kind of relive it. And she's been after me pretty intensely for probably the last 5 or 6 years. So we decided that we would just in the last year, we decided to go ahead and do it, and we did.
Larry, tell me about growing up in Stowe, Ohio.
Well, I grew up in the country, and Stowe, Ohio is very much in the country. Northeastern Ohio, probably 30 miles southwest of Cleveland, about 12 miles from Akron. And very rural in the sense the dairy farms and country was the rule of thumb. That's back in the early 50s, the middle 50s. And, well, life was just different. It was pretty rugged. It was pretty down to earth. It was pretty easy to understand. I think it was all in all, I look back upon it, as I mentioned in the book, I couldn't trade it. At the time, I was a little bored with it. I wanted to be other places. But when I got away later in life and realized how wonderful a childhood I had because of where I was at and the people that were around me, made me appreciate it.
Larry, how did you end up at Syracuse University?
Well, I think I owe that to a guy named Jim Brown, the Cleveland Browns. I used to, as a kid growing up there around Cleveland, we got to sneak into a couple of games and actually got to go to a couple of games legally through the Little League and different things. And had an opportunity to watch him run the ball and see a great football team operate. And then was fortunate enough to enjoy a great high school career, had a great football team around me, was very much a part of it. And then had the opportunity to go and talk with Ben Schwartzholder at Syracuse, the guy that coached Jim Brown as a player at Syracuse, and have him offer me the opportunity of taking a look at whether I could do it or not if I came to Syracuse. So that's what I did, and it fell in line from there.
Tell me more about Coach Ben.
Well, Ben was a very decorated World War II veteran, man of his word, intense, I think, is the word I want to drive home. And when I was around him just as a high school student, just visiting with him in regards to the possibility of going to Syracuse, I realized that he was, because of his career and what I knew about him from reading about him in World War II, that he was very sincere, very down to earth, and an honorable man. And I thought, being a sought-after defensive end in high school, not really wanting to play defensive end position at college, I wanted to have the opportunity to see if I could run the ball, and I thought Syracuse was the place to do it. Power running game was what they promoted. So I just, when he came to call on me and asked me if I was interested in going to Syracuse, I just put it to him. I said, if I come there, do I have your word that you'll give me an opportunity or take a look at me as a running back, not just as a defensive end or middle linebacker?
Mm-hmm.
And he stood and stared at me and took about 30 seconds, which made me uncomfortable, staring right at me, and pushed his glasses up the way he used to with his thumb and said, yes, I will. And that was good enough for me. So I turned Clemson down and decided to go to Syracuse. Turned down Ohio State, too. And those were very good places that I just mentioned, and I was very interested in both of them. But at the same time, what Ben Schwarzwalder had accomplished with Jimmy Brown, Ernie Davis, Floyd Little, a raft of people before me, was, I thought, an opportunity for me to possibly be a running back in college, if not perhaps in the pros.
When did you realize, Larry, that you could be an NFL player?
Well, quite frankly, I was of the persuasion that I could go on to the NFL because it was sought after in the college draft and went high in the draft, so I thought it's going to be a natural accomplishment. But at the same time, getting to the NFL and being drafted by the Miami Dolphins and being my first year or two affiliated with a team was probably one of the worst teams in the league for that year. It wasn't a very ingratiating start. It was hardcore. It came right down to the wire to where my career could have very easily ended, just a flip of a coin my first year because of head injury and the things that I went through as a rookie outlined as a book. But then we got a guy named Shula that came to us in 1970, my third year in the pros. And let me tell you something, Pat, you know what I'm talking about. He had dedication, design, organization, and a will to win. And he turned things around the likes I'd never seen before. I saw a lot of those things, those attributes I just listed. I saw a lot of that at Syracuse, but not with the intensity that I saw coming from Don Shula and his coaching staff in the pros.
Mm. Was he a great leader?
Yes, in the sense that he, not when you think of military leaders charging up the hill, no, not necessarily. But when you think about preparation, study the game plan. We're going to attack this with our strengths, and we're going to attack this with knowledge. We're not just going to run blindly up the hill waving flags. We're going to think about what we're going to do and execute those things. And it comes down to detail. And you know what I'm talking about. You've been to the mountaintop in several different team sports. You know what I'm talking about. It's when you care about more as a player.
Yes.
You care more about winning than you care about personal glorification or personal recognition. When you care more about the team and getting it right and doing it right than you worry about personal recognition, then you're on the right track at that point. And I think he put us on that track.
Larry, what do you remember about the city of Miami when you first got there?
Oh, my. Well, that was a time of turmoil. Certainly, Miami was no stranger to it than any other city, particularly Deep South. Racial strife, ethnic differences was literally tearing the city apart, in my belief. And I think what happened when Coach Shula came to us and we started to win a little bit, started to turn things around, if you will, it created an excitement that engaged different facets and pieces of the city to be a little more tolerant of each other and come together over something. I think when we all look at the differences we have, instead of the common things that we have in common, we tend to separate from each other. But when we have some common bond that we can start with, I think that was it certainly wasn't the only cause. I think people naturally want to come together and become a unit. And I think they formed around the football team there at that time, and it helped Miami mature as a city and come together. And I was the Orange Bowl, luckily, and I say luckily at the time, I wasn't, that thing was so lucky, but it was right in the heart of one of the most strifeful districts in the city. So to see people staying after the games and sitting around campfires and sharing hot dogs and talking of different ethnic backgrounds doing that it started to form a germ that started to spread in the city, and it started to it started to bring things together. Now, I'm not going to insult your intelligence and say it was the key thing and did all that. I think it was one of the things that started to bring people together at that time in Miami for that period of time in our history. And I think it lent a good feeling to an otherwise very strifeful time and a very much of a hardship for the city. I think that turned things around a little bit. It helped to turn things around. It certainly wasn't the single factor. People have to be tolerant of each other and want to get together, but they need to rally around something. And I think at that time, we were one of the few positive things that was in the paper. And I think people started to rally, and I think it worked. It helped.
Larry Zonka's new book is out. It's called Head On, a Memoir. Larry, what do you remember about Joe Robbie?
Well, I'm sorry I laughed, because Joe was a very colorful character. He did a whole lot with very little. And if you read about it in the book, this guy, there was times when Joe and I were down nose to nose and tooth to tooth and didn't like each other. There was no bones about it. But at the same time, we had a common goal, and the success of the Dolphins was that. And the success of Miami, it was that. And looking back on it, it's kind of funny at points, but at times when I was going through it, I'm sure I speak for both of us, we would have easily liked to jump up and choke each other a couple of times, but that wasn't in the cards. So he did what he had to do, and I did what I had to do, and the rest of us all fell in line with that kind of philosophy. I think without Joe, there wouldn't have been any Miami Dolphins to start with. And he walked a tightrope and managed to get through it, convinced people. He is one heck of a salesman. I got to give you that.
Larry Zonka is our guest. We have another segment with Larry. We need to take a break here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and you're tuned in to AM 950. And FM 94.9, The Answer, in Orlando. When we come back, my first question with Larry is, on those Dolphin teams, who are your three most memorable teammates? Stay with us here. Again, it's Inside the Game, AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer, in Orlando. And Larry Zonka's book is out. Go get it. Head On. A Memoir. It's a good read. Larry Zonka, the great Miami Dolphin running back, has written his memoirs, Head On, a Memoir. And Larry, as I mentioned before the break, boy, what memorable players on that team. Three teammates that really left a mark on you.
Well, quite frankly, Pat, you know what I'm talking about. You've been affiliated with team sports your whole career. You know what I'm about to say. To try to single out three would be almost impossible for me. But I think the easiest road to this is certainly no one is more important than any other. And sometimes at different times, different things happened. But if I had to go back and relive that particular year of 72, I would think our three team captains, Nick Bonacani, Bob Greasy, Larry Little, and I'd have to throw Earl Morrill, our backup quarterback that took over from Bob Greasy.
Yes.
Those three guys were the leaders that year. And they stood up, argued with Shula, they argued with the referees. I think they actually argued with fate at different times, because they, you know, it was a mind over matter situation. And I think what was encouraged by those three people, those three individuals or four individuals that I've alluded to, was putting winning over personal recognition. In the case of Bob Greasy, the quarterback, you know, he wanted to do whatever it took to win. Same with Nick Bonacani, defensive middle linebacker, a great player, a great thinker. a guy that just was so intense that it literally oozed out of him. And as I mentioned, Earl Morrill being the backup quarterback that came, you'll read in the book, if you read the book about it, when Bob was hurt, Bob Greasy, our quarterback, was hurt, I think, against San Diego in, I think, the third or fourth game, Earl Morrill came on and just absolutely never missed, the team never missed a beat. It was like it was just synchromeshed right together. It was just almost like it had been planned. And I think that's we owe great debt to Shula for having an opportunity to get Earl and having a backup quarterback of that caliber there to step in. But what a leader that guy was. Mm. You know, to see those three, Greasy, Earl Morrill, Dick Bonaconi, to see those guys, Larry Little, in action, and how much they were stand-up leader guys that took charge and went after it. I go on about it a little bit in a book. I probably wear you out talking to you on the radio about it. But there were moments when literally it was 1 second to the next whether we would get that perfect season down or we would lose a game. And sometimes it was just a matter of a few words from one of those individuals that I've alluded to that made the difference in us stepping up and winning the game or coming away with a loss.
Mm. My guest is Larry Zonka. Hey, Larry, by the way, how did you end up wearing number 39?
Well, that was the number they handed me at college. Everything else was taken. You know, I grew up a fan of Jim Brown. I was 32 in high school. I would like to have been 32, I guess. But when I got to Syracuse, 32 was taken. We had a guy named Jim Chayansky, who was a defensive captain. Middle linebacker, and he had 32. So next number they handed me was 39. So I started wearing 39, and it started working out pretty good. And me and 39 got to be buddies, and so I just stayed with it. didn't follow that dream quite as fast or far as I had thought back in the days of high school or so on when I was wearing 32. But 39, that's the number that came up at Syracuse, and I liked it. So when I got to the pros, they asked me what number I would like. If they had it, they'd give it to me. And I said, well, I'll stick with 39 if that's what you've got. And they said, fine, nobody else wants it. So there I was.
What, Larry, are the pluses and minuses of being born on Christmas Day?
Well, I think the plus is certainly everyone remembers your birthday and wishes you a happy birthday. That's a great thing. I was probably 5 or 6 years old before I finally realized that everybody wasn't celebrating about me. When you're 4 or 5, you think, yeah, this is a great birthday to have, you know. As I got older, I think it's nice to be born on Christmas, but it's also just nice to have people remember your birthday whenever it is. I think that's a family thing and, you know, a positive thing.
Larry, tell me about your memories of 1975 with the Memphis Southmen.
Well, Memphis Southmen were quite a hit there in Memphis. John Bassett had drafted myself and Jim Kick and Paul Warfield and brought us over from the NFL to play for the Toronto franchise that he had, but then it was disallowed in order to protect the Canadian Football League. They literally threw the new franchise out, and it relocated in Memphis, which, you know, I was all set to go to Canada, but at the last moments it turned around and we ended up in Memphis, which was still a very enthusiastic place. A lot of people showed up. We got to meet Elvis Presley, Jim Kick, myself, and Elvis got together a couple times. Now I should rephrase that. I brought it up in the book. I got to meet Elvis, got to shoot pool or watch him and Jim Kick shoot pool at his Graceland over there several times. He and Elvis had a lot in common with music and pool. I did not. But Elvis did like football, and he liked to talk football. Mm. And we did have some great conversations over cocktails and coffee and different things sitting around his place. And he had some very intelligent questions. He asked about things that make a difference on the field. He was a something of a football scholar. I knew nothing about music. and little about pool. So we did talk quite a bit about football, though.
Isn't that fascinating? How did you end up with the New York Giants for those 3 years, 76, 77, and 78? How did that happen?
Well, Bill Arnsberger, our defensive coordinator back in 72 with the Dolphins, was the head coach of the Giants at that point. And he had a very vivid memory of what, the part I played with the team in Miami, and wanted me there if he could get me there. And I owe that to him, that contract got picked up in its entirety by the New York Giants, and that's how I ended up there. It was first offered to Miami, and Joe Robbie wasn't interested in it, said the numbers were ridiculous and no one would pay that. 36 hours later, we signed with the New York Giants, and I went to play for Bill Arnsberger.
What were your years like in New York? Did you like the big city?
No. I shouldn't say no entirely. I did like being there. It was an experience. I realized that I was a small-town farm kid and had thought about the city and always been very excited about getting there. I saw it kind of through Jim Kick's eyes. We were roommates with the Dolphins. He grew up in New Jersey and spent a lot of time in New York, and he talked about all the places, and I got to go to a lot of those places with him and different times with different folks throughout the 3 year tenure that I spent there in New York. And I had a great appreciation for New York. I realized that I'm a farm kid, not a downtown kind of guy. So while I like the city, I don't want to live in the city. And I think that I go into that in the book. I don't put down the fact that people like to live in the city. I think that's great, but it's just what you like, what you care for. I haven't grown up in the country. I think I lean a little more that way. And I like to see the open plains. I like to hunt and fish and be out in the wild, and spend a lot of time in Alaska because of that. And was afforded that opportunity through the success I enjoyed in football.
Larry, how did you end up back with the Dolphins for the 79 season, and what was that like?
Well, I went into this a little bit in the book. I was getting up there as far as a running back's concerned. You start getting double-digit tenure as a running back at a very different football game back then. The rules have changed a great deal. Not to say it's not a very action-filled game today. It certainly is, probably more competitive than it's ever been. But to play under those rules back then, for that long as a power running back in a ball-control offense, was really unusual. I had an opportunity to come back. I went down and signed an agreement with the Dolphins for 1 year to be a blocking back for Delvin Williams. Turned out that things happened and Delvin wasn't with us for the whole season. And as a result, I ended up being the number one ball carrier at ripe old age of 30, I think. I was carrying the ball, 20, 30 times a game, and that was a very taxing situation. But I got through it. We got to the playoffs. We lost in the first round against Pittsburgh. And they went on to win the championship, I believe, that year. But that was it was a great year of coming back, and I'm glad that I got to spend my last year in pro football with Don Shula. Quite frankly, it was kind of a payoff. I didn't make a lot of money coming back. Certainly, it wasn't about the money anymore. It was about being home and being around some of the players that were there when I left originally.
How did you know when it was time to wrap it up?
Well, they fired me. I kid about that. I couldn't come to terms with Joe Robbie, but I didn't. I look back upon it. It was, I think, for me to go on and play another year at that point in time in my life was really starting to walk the tightrope as far as a severe injury that could have been, life-affecting in the sense of being handicapped or being damaged to a point where you have a lifelong problem. I had suffered a lot of injuries through the course of my career that that were severe enough that they haunt me a little today. But I'm glad that it came to an end when it did, because I don't think I would have made the difference in the next year or two for the Dolphins. But I do think that that you started getting into your early 30s and you're still a power running back. Statistically, that's a very slanted board to be on. So all in all, I was pretty glad that it happened the way it did. I was sorry that I left in a huff and Coach Shula had to fire me, but that's, so what? That's, it's business. We all knew that. And I was very, very lucky to have been where I was when I was, and we all achieved the results that we did. You know what it's like, Pat. You've been up the mountain. You've been on top of it five or six times at least through team sports. You know what I'm talking about. To go there one time, plan it, and then achieve it is a great, great feeling. Nice to be part of that. You know what I'm talking about.
I do, Larry, and it's so nice to visit with you. Larry Zonka has been our guest. Make sure you get his book. It's called Head On, a Memoir, and a terrific read. We have more after this on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and this is AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Miami Dolphins running back, our guest in that first segment. He's in the east coast of Florida. We go out to L.A., a long jaunt, and we have found Dr. Sean Anderson, Associate Professor of Organizational Communication at Loyola Marymount University in L.A. And we're going to talk about his book, The Black Athlete Revolt, The Sport Justice Movement in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Sean, I'm so pleased to catch up with you. Welcome to Orlando.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how this book came about.
Yeah, so, I took an observation. You know, of course, as a researcher, we're having to observe the landscape. And I took a look over the last 5 years. And took inventory of sort of this revitalization of athlete activism, particularly in the age of Black Lives Matter. You know, we're here at the 10-year anniversary of when that hashtag was first put out there on Twitter. And I wanted to give sort of this illumination of how athletes are using their platform to not only just of course, engage in protests, but also now begin conversations on policy reform.
Sean, the first chapter that you write is called Sport and Politics, an Unholy Matrimony.
Yes.
I need you to expand on that.
Sure. So, you know, we think about any type of relationship, marriage, you know, it's the ultimate goal for some people. You know, there's a lot of give and take, right? A lot of tension sometimes, a lot of great things, a lot of not so great. And so what I wanted to really point out relative to that notion was that sport and politics has been around, first of all, longer than many people may imagine. Many people will probably pinpoint it to the civil rights movement. But I take it all the way back to 10 years after the Civil War, when we had black jockeys who participated in that sport, who then by 1896 was virtually eliminated from the sport because of the separate but equal clause that was, put into notion in our country. And so we've had this ebb and flow with sports. And politics, of course, us loving sport for entertainment purposes, but also some people getting mad at athletes for speaking out about social injustice. And so the first chapter was to show us that sport and politics has been around a lot longer than we have imagined, and there is a necessity for it.
Let's get to the second topic you write about. All lives matter. Well, except, I think I said that right. Tell us more on that.
So, yeah, so that chapter really focused on essentially what the Black Lives Matter movement was all about. You know, there's been an argument since the Black Lives Matter movement started that, you know, well, why do Black people only matter over others? You know, why is it that Black people get to have this sort of separate push of praise and understanding in the country when other people struggle too? Well, in the sense of the well accept, it's quite the reverse of that notion that's been placed out there, in the sense of saying that the people who started the movement were not saying that Black lives matter over everybody else's. It's just that when it comes to the issues in our society, that Black lives should matter as much as everybody else's. But with the things that we've seen when it comes to racial profiling, police brutality, criminal injustice, you know, there's been a propensity to see more Black people at the wrong end of the situation relative to getting shot or whatever the case may be. And so this chapter was essentially showcasing why the movement began, how the All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter sort of, you know, social media platforms, you know, kind of came about in opposition to Black Lives Matter, and where we should have this holistic understanding that no one is saying that somebody else's life should matter over others. It's just that all lives should matter equally.
Now, let me tell you once again that our guest is Dr. Sean Anderson. He's at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. The book is called The Black Athlete Revolt. And Sean, united we stand, divided we kneel. Tell us what you're writing there in the third topic.
So the third topic there is looking at the way that the national anthem in 2016 was sort of taken to task by a former NFL quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, who initially sat during a preseason game, but then had a conversation with a military person and eventually took the knee in direct context to the issues that were going on in our society. And so what we know when it comes to the playing of the national anthem, you know, you're asked to stand and or hold your hand over your chest in acknowledgement of that. But Colin Kaepernick, who essentially served as a martyr, like I say, again, in 2016, took the knee, which subsequently had us in, as a country divided by that action. On the end of those who supported him, of course, it was the praise for using a platform, a very powerful and strong platform of the NFL, to talk about social injustice. And then, of course, you had other people on other sides who were saying that, you know, you're betraying the country. If you don't like what's going on in this country, that you should leave, you know, some of that banter that's usually there. But what made it relevant and what made it important was that, again, this is the revitalization of athlete activism. We began to see several high-profile athletes use that platform to talk about the injustices of society. And, of course, what it caused was, you know, arguments and disagreements on either side of the kneeling. And so that chapter was to explain what's going on, what should we do about it, and where should our future go?
Once again, we're chatting with Sean Anderson. He is in Los Angeles. Sean, how about this topic? We want reform. What are you telling us?
So, after the Colin Kaepernick Neil, you know, we had 4 years of sort of a back and forth with athletes, sport organizations, sport apparel companies like Nike, Under Armour, Reebok, who in many cases were all trying to figure out how to navigate what we should do, you know, beyond the protests. And so by 2020, that is when the revitalization of athlete activism was sort of brought to its full fruition. So, of course, we had to deal with COVID and all of those things that were going on. But again, we began to see not only athletes from the NFL, the NBAs, MLS, all of these other sports, but we began to see it across other sports as well, such as the WNBA, who I believe was very underrated when it came to athlete activism. We had the women's professional soccer team. Also, we saw growth in the Olympics, where athletes began to talk about several issues that our society is facing, especially when it comes to things such as mental illness, pay inequity, community development. And so the We Want Reform concept really came about how athletes then began to say, okay, we need to go to our governments. We need to go to our local, state, federal governments, ask for laws, fight for these laws, and push forward an agenda that leads to positive and tangible social change.
We're chatting with Dr. Sean Anderson, the Black Athlete Revolt. Sean, before the break here, I want to learn a little bit more about you. Where did you grow up, and what's your sports background? And tell us, who is Dr. Sean Anderson?
Sure. So I grew up in the rural South. Grew up in a small city called Pine Bluff, Arkansas, predominantly Black city, about 30 minutes south of the capital of Little Rock. Grew up in a city where in the South, where if you don't play football, you're not popular, right? And so I found myself playing little league sports coming up, played some sports in junior high, a little bit in high school, but I had this mentality of, you know, in many cases, why is it that I have to play? Why can't I own a team? Why can't I move in that direction in sports? And so had a knee injury, which kind of derailed that athletic career, and went on into, again, understanding how sport has had this influence in our society in a myriad of ways. And so went on and pursued an undergraduate degree, a master's degree, and earned my doctorate in 2016. And I've been a professor ever since. And this is how I got to this position.
Dr. Sean Anderson is our guest. We need to take a break. And when we come back, Sean's going to talk to us about topic number five. It's called the Sport Justice Movement. You're listening to Inside the Game. We talk sports every weekend. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And you're tuned in to AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We will be right back. Dr. Sean Anderson is in California, L.A., Loyola Marymount University. We're talking about his book, The Black Athlete Revolt, The Sport Justice Movement in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Sean, we're at topic five, the Sport Justice Movement. It's all yours. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the Sport Justice Movement is what I considered the birth of something that came from the Black Lives Matter movement, where, of course, we saw that movement take helm of the understandings of, you know, what needed to be done for black communities in our country. Of course, while also not trying to put down other communities, but just to say that black lives mattered as well. But the Squad Justice Movement, from what I saw and from our research I put together, was essentially this culmination of understanding that sport and politics will not go away as long as we have social injustice in our society, and that the politics of relative, again, to criminal justice reform, to all of the factors of things that have really, you know, hindered the growth of our society for marginalized people, the overall understandings and concepts of sport justice, where we go from here, and where we should go in myriad of ways, brings about this understanding of how athletes have now solidified and found themselves being the leaders in our society for talking about the injustices that they see and they face, and they no longer are hiding behind their money and influence, but they're taking that platform to bring about tangible social change. Now, it hasn't been a perfect movement. They're still learning, but this is where we are in our society today, and things will continue to grow from there.
Sean, tell me the athletes, past and current, that you really admire.
So my favorite athlete of all time is Muhammad Ali. I believe that from as great as he was, in the boxing arena, he was, you know, that much more outside of it. When he first started, you know, the commentators were calling him the Louisville Lip for his sort of brash, you know, understandings of himself, his thoughts about other boxers. But as he went from, of course, the name of Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, because of his connection to the Nation of Islam, he began to challenge the country in many ways. So even when he was dismissed from boxing because of dodging the Vietnam War, he was going all over the world, speaking at universities, advocating for you know, social change, and was a key component of the civil rights movement during that time. So for his legacy, I think it's very uncanny. Today, I give credit to athletes such as Renee Montgomery of the WNBA, who essentially put a team together to purchase the former team that she played for in a move to solidify the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I see Serena Williams. You know, I see, of course, Colin Kaepernick, LeBron James, as other figures who are important to the movement.
My guest is Sean Anderson, the Black Athlete Revolt. I want you to expand on that word revolt. What does that word mean to you?
So, yeah, so, you know, this was actually in connection to essentially the father of sport and sociology, who is Dr. Harry Edwards.
Yes.
Who back in the late 1960s was one of the chief architects to the 1968 Olympic protests, where we saw the black power fist being raised. And so he wrote a book back then that was, again, my loose translation of the title, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, which he wrote back then. And so from his perspective, of course, it was about the athletes who protested during the civil rights movement and all the challenges that they had to face. And so the revolt for me is now looking at how our society has changed because of the advent of technology. People are being more expressive about their thoughts, and I bring that about to the athletes of today as well, because with the advent of Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, all of these places, we're beginning to see these athletes tell their stories from their perspective, not a third party, not anyone else that's running interference. And so the revolt now is again, the athletes recognizing their strengths, you know, seeing where they can progress our country, even the globe, and how they are, you know, taking heed of the necessity of these types of movements moving forward.
Sean, I'm intrigued with your work at Loyola Marymount, professor of organizational communication. What does all that entail?
Yeah, so organizational communication looks at how communication messages, things such as decision-making, you know, changes within the organization, how these things are communicated from the top to bottom, bottom to top, how it's also communicated from the organization to its stakeholders. And so my work essentially looks at how that flows, the ebbs and flows of organizations, and how, again, let's say, for example, if an organization is trying to push forward an initiative, how are they communicating it to the people that will be affected? How are those people communicating back to the organization? And with the emphasis of trying to create a mutual understanding between those entities.
Sean, tell me about the sports scene in Los Angeles where you live. That's a big question, but just give me an update on what's going on in sports in L.A.
So, yeah, so there was a meeting a couple of years ago with the former mayor, Mayor Garcetti, who proclaimed that he wanted to create the sport and entertainment hub of the United States within Los Angeles. And so you're talking about over 10, I think 11 professional sport teams. You have so many other nonprofit organizations that work with sport organizations around Los Angeles. And so we also have the 2028 Olympics coming here and the 2026 World Cup. So there are several things that are going on in Los Angeles relative to the sport world. But because of that, you're actually seeing a lot of other things being revised throughout the city and surrounding counties. You know, they're trying to find ways to reduce traffic, build better transportation systems for people to go to and from. And so the landscape of sport in Los Angeles is sort of like the exemplar of what we see in major cities, where sports, while of course the premise is to be an entertainment vehicle, it has larger implications on how cities are developed, how communities are structured, and again, how revenue or gains and losses are essentially brought about in a city over a 5-tier, 10, and 20-year period.
In closing, I'm going to give you athletes' names. You tell me the first thing you think about
All right.
with that athlete. Jackie Robinson.
Pioneer.
Jesse Owens.
Fast.
Joe Louis.
Structure.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
An anomaly.
Florence Griffith Joyner, FloJo.
An artist.
Serena Williams.
The greatest.
Venus Williams.
The architect.
The Williams girl's father.
The blueprint.
Dusty Baker.
Longevity.
Willie Mays.
The King.
Don Newcomb.
Inspiring.
Yeah. Kind of fun.
Yeah.
Did you have a boyhood sports idol as a kid growing up in Arkansas?
I did. As a small child, I remember seeing Ozzie Smith. Every time he would run out to second base for the St. Louis Cardinals, he would do that iconic flip.
Yes.
And I used to tell my grandfather, I want to be able to grow up and do that one day. You know, so that was great for me to see.
Sean, what are you going to be doing with your life 20 years from now?
20 years from now, I would love to be in a position to pass on the work that I have been doing to the next generation of leaders. You know, still mentoring, loving my children whenever I, of course, have some. And, you know, enjoying life and seeing what the next adventure holds.
Our guest, Dr. Sean Anderson, the book, powerful book, The Black Athlete Revolt. Well, thanks for joining us here on Inside the Game. I've been your host, Pat Williams. You're listening to AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We will be back next week for more sports talk. Have a wonderful week ahead. And take care and take charge.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.